research at Caltech on quasars and galaxies, but I've also served as a pastor in a church that's sandwiched between Caltech and the Jet Propulsion Laboratory in the Pasadena area. And I've been in that role for, the past four decades. But I'm also the founder and president of Reasons to Believe. And you can contact us at Reasons to Believe through a variety of social media. We actually have a 24/7 YouTube channel where you can watch our video clips all day long if you prefer. And if you text HUE to 31996, that's your portal to receive all kinds of free videos, book chapters, articles, and much more. And I'm going to try to leave some time for questions and discussion in this 55-minute segment. But if you don't get to ask your question today, and if you're like me, you think you're the best question 3 hours after the event is over. If that's you, then I do answer questions that I get on both my Facebook and Twitter pages. So, yes, please feel free to engage me anytime after this is over. And we are giving away a free chapter of The Creator and the Cosmos. All you need to do is go to reasons.org/Ross, and you can get a free chapter of The Creator and the Cosmos. It's now in its fourth edition, basically demonstrating that the more we learn about science, the stronger case we get for the God of the Bible. And we're also giving away a free chapter of Navigating Genesis, which will be kind of the focus of the talk I'm giving today, and our latest book, Always Be Ready, which basically makes the point, if you prepare good reasons for the hope that you have in Jesus Christ and can deliver those good reasons with gentleness, respect, and a clear conscience, you will see God doing supernatural miracles in your life to bring people to you that are prepared to hear and respond to those good reasons. And you'll see lots of stories in the book that document that that can happen to anyone who prepares those good reasons. But yeah, we're giving away a free chapter of that as well. And if you want the full-length books, we have a booth here at the conference. But the whole focus of the conference is the God who wants us to do something. And so I picked the topic, the God who wants us to test. Because that's one of the things that appealed to me. I was not raised in a Christian home, but when I began to go through the holy books, religions of the world, I discovered only the Bible invited objective testing. I didn't see that in any other holy book. A couple of examples. You got Malachi chapter 3, where God says, put me to the test, and I'll prove it to you. Or what you see in the New Testament, 1 Thessalonians 5:21, everything must be tested, and hold on to that which proves to be good. And so what I want to do this morning is show you how we can test Genesis with the latest science, basically making the point that the more we learn about science, the stronger case we get for the complete accuracy, reliability, inerrancy of the opening chapters of Genesis. And you say, why are you picking these opening chapters of Genesis? Because that's the primary reason for why skeptics reject the Bible as the Word of God. I mean, for example, how many of you have ever heard someone say, science contradicts Genesis? That ever happened to you? Yeah, it's happened to me many times. In fact, I got stories in my latest book, Always Be Ready, of being on an airplane and somebody figures out that I'm a believer and they say, well, science proves that the Bible is wrong. And then I get some interesting opportunities. All right. But I tell a story of how I was in the hospital recovering from surgery and I got visited by five chaplains. Four of those five chaplains were not believers. So I asked them why they weren't believers. And they said, well, science contradicts Genesis. So I said, well, have you ever met a scientist who actually believes that Genesis is the inspired and inerrant word of God? And they said, we don't think such a scientist exists. So, but what I'm discovering as I speak on seminary campuses and as I speak in universities is that today theologians and scientists are trying to reconcile Genesis and science, but the way they're trying to reconcile them is to say that Genesis is not historical. It's simply a metaphor, or it's a piece of figurative poetry, that it's not really an historical account of physical reality. I'll give you an example. This is one from Dennis Alexander in his book where he says, those who maintain the historical view of Genesis are embarrassing and bring the gospel into disrepute. Here's the problem. Take Genesis chapter 1, put it in front of any unbeliever, and ask him, what do you think this is saying? Every time I've done that, 100% of the time, they say this is obviously a chronology of historical events, of God doing things at different times. Genesis 1 reads exactly like an historical account of actual events. So to deny the historicity of Genesis puts you in a very difficult position in trying to persuade people that the Bible is the inspired, inerrant Word of God. I mean, the days are numbered. You got the repeated phrase, and it was so, and God saying it was good. I mean, Moses couldn't have done any more to convince you that this is actually a chronology of physical events. And the problem with Alexander is that he failed to follow the biblical testing method and to integrate all the Bible's creation texts. Genesis is not the only text on creation. In fact, in Job, we have a much more extensive account of creation than we do in the book of Genesis. In fact, if you go on our reasons.org website, you'll see there are over 24 chapter length or longer accounts in the Bible that deal with the subject of science and creation. And so it's crucial that we not only look at Genesis, we integrate it with everything else the Bible's got to say, and we follow the biblical testing method, a.k.a. the scientific method. It's no accident that the scientific revolution exploded out of Reformation Europe. That's when people began to read the Bible for themselves, and those with a scientific bent saw this biblical testing method. That was the origin of what we now call the scientific method. So I prefer to call it the biblical testing method. So what I want to do in the next few minutes is show you how we can transform Genesis 1 from the Bible's greatest embarrassment into one of the best reasons we have to believe the Bible is the inspired, inerrant Word of God. And if you come to the panel discussion that I'm going to be part of tonight, that's one of the big questions we're going to be talking about, is biblical inerrancy. And we're going to do this transformation through following the biblical testing method. So let's begin. Now, I've spoken in I don't know how many countries around the world, over 40. And what I've discovered is no matter where I go, everybody knows the first sentence of the Bible. They may not have ever read the Gospels. They may not even know that there's a Jesus of Nazareth. But they do know, in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. They may not realize, however, that this phrase, the heavens and the earth, means the entire universe. There is no Hebrew word for universe, but they have this phrase, shamayan ares, with the definite articles. It means the entirety of physical reality, all matter, all energy, and all space and time. And you'll see that phrase repeated 9 times in the Old Testament. Now, I was reading Genesis for the first time at the same time that physicists in Britain and South Africa were developing the first of the space-time theorems. How many of you in this audience have ever heard of the space-time theorems? Oh, quite a few of you. I'm really impressed. Well, for the rest of you, I actually brought one of those space-time theorems with me for you to read. It's fascinating reading. If you love tensor calculus, you won't be able to put this thing down. But it ends with a sentence that I think you can all understand, which basically makes the point. If the universe expands on average, and only a universe that's expanding will permit the existence of life, any universe that expands on average must have a beginning of space and time. So the very fact that you're here proves that the universe has a beginning and that there is an actual beginning of space and time. And this is just one of 30 space-time theorems that have been published. And what I want to do is share with you a quote from one of the three authors of this particular paper, Alexander Vilenkin. And what he wrote in his book, published a year and a half after this paper, he said, "With the proof now in place, cosmologists can no longer hide behind the possibility of a past eternal universe. There is no escape. They have to face the possibility, the problem, the certainty of a cosmic beginning." And the problem that Alexander Vilenkin was referring to is that proof of a space-time beginning implies a causal agent beyond space and time who creates our universe of space, time, matter, and energy. In other words, a miracle-working God must exist. And if you actually read the latest books being published by atheist physicists and astronomers, they're conceding this point. They're saying that deism cannot be taken off the scientific table because of the force of the observational evidence for the beginning of the universe and the space-time theorems. Now, we've only been here for a few minutes, but already what we've done is basically demonstrate from the very first sentence of the Bible that the God of the Bible indeed must be responsible for the universe. The gods of the other religions create within space and time. The God of the Bible creates independent of space and time. Space and time don't exist until the universe comes into existence. And now we got the scientific proof that that is correct. With the remainder of my time here, I want to go through three key points. Step one of the biblical testing method, which basically states, don't interpret until you first establish the point of view. Then we're going to look at the meaning of this word day, which is also going to be the subject of the panel discussion tonight or this afternoon. And then I really want to focus on putting to the test with the latest science the description and the order of the events of creation. And we'll begin with number one, the point of view. The point of view for Genesis 1:1 is the universe, but Genesis 1:2 changes the point of view from the universe to the surface of the earth. The Spirit of God was hovering over the face of the waters of planet Earth. Or to give you a diagram, we're to interpret the 6 days of creation from the perspective of an observer on the surface of the oceans of the world, underneath the clouds, not above the clouds. Now, I'm sure many of you run into scientists and engineers who have said that Genesis 1 teaches scientific nonsense. I would also agree with that conclusion if I had the point of view above the clouds. If it's above the clouds, Genesis 1 is teaching total scientific nonsense. But what I'm going to demonstrate to you, if you put the point of view on the surface of the waters, underneath the cloud layers, we now see we get a perfect fit with the established scientific record and the account of the 6 days of creation. Now, this is implied in Genesis 1:2 because it also gives us the initial conditions. It tells us water covers the whole surface of the earth and it's dark on the surface of the waters, implying it's dark because of the clouds that are blanketing the earth. But in Job, which is a much more extensive account of creation, Job 37:38 and 39, we see this statement. God speaks and he says, I made the clouds its garment and wrapped it in thick darkness. So notice here in Job, it's explicit for why it's dark on the surface of the waters. It's not dark because there is no sun, moon, and stars. It's dark because the clouds would not let the light of the sun, moon, and stars through to the surface of the waters of planet Earth. Now, I was 17 when I was reading this for the first time, and as a young astronomy student, I knew that planet Earth began with an atmosphere 200 times thicker than the atmosphere it has today. An atmosphere that thick will not let any light pass through. Okay. Point two in my outline. What about this word day? Well, I know there's a big debate today about what this word day means in Genesis chapter 1. I was not attending church until I was 27 years of age. I became a Christian at age 19 after a 2-year study of the Bible. But one of the things I noticed right away in looking at Genesis 1 is that there has to be at least 3 distinct literal definitions for this word day, because 3 are used right there in the first page. Creation day 1, you see that it's contrasting days and nights. That's day for the daylight hours. On creation day 4, it's contrasting seasons, days, and years. That's day for 24 hours. But Genesis 2:4 uses the word day to refer to the entirety of creation history, and that's day as a long period of time. Now, if you pick up a Hebrew lexicon, you'll actually discover there's 4 distinct literal definitions for this word yom that's translated as day. It can also mean part of the daylight hours, like from noon to 3 p.m. Now, as I continued to read through the Bible, I first discovered, number one, the creation days are bracketed by an evening and a morning. That's true the first six creation days. There is no evening and morning for the seventh day. And so I remember reading that at age 17 and saying, could it be we're still in the seventh day? And as I read on in the Bible, I found three texts that tell us we're still in God's seventh day. Now, another part of my story is that I became rather compulsive about studying astronomy when I was 7 years of age. I was reading five books on astronomy and physics per week, and that kind of got my parents worried. And so at age 10 and a half, they bought our family a big, thick book on evolutionary biology, trying to broaden me a little bit. I was the only one in the family that read the book. But I went to my parents and says, Mom, Dad, the numbers don't add up. We got all this speciation before humanity and hardly any afterwards. Can you tell me why? They said, go ask your science teachers. My science teacher said, go talk to those professors you know at the university. And they told me they didn't know. When I picked up Genesis 1 at age 17, it answered the fossil record enigma. For 6 days God creates. On the seventh day he stops creating. We see all the speciation before human beings because those are the 6 days in which God is creating new species of life. We're not seeing it today because God is resting from his work of creation. All we see is a very small amount of naturalistic speciation events taking place. So God's rest answers the fossil record enigma. We see an average of one new species appearing per year before human beings, but virtually none afterwards. Now, if you want to read more about this, I'm not sure we have it at the table downstairs, but you can get it at reasons.org. I've written a whole book, A Matter of Days, that deals with the subject of the length of the creation days in Genesis chapter 1, and I'm sure that's going to be the topic of the panel discussion that'll take place later this afternoon. But I want to spend most of my time putting to the test the order and description of the creation events in the 6 days of creation. And what I want to show you is how the evidence that this matches what we see in the book of nature becomes progressively more and more tight as we go from the 1950s right up to just a couple of months ago. And that's kind of the principle we're developing at Reasons to Believe. Namely, that the more we learn about science, the more evidence we get for the Christian faith, and we're getting that evidence literally on a daily basis. And that's one reason why we see us posting new scientific evidence for the Christian faith regularly on our reasons.org website. But let's begin. Creation day one, let there be light. Notice the text doesn't say that this is when God creates light or makes light. He did that in the beginning. Genesis 1:1 is when God creates the universe of matter, energy, space, and time. So light pervaded the universe from the very beginning of the universe, but it was dark on the surface of the waters. So Genesis 1:3 is making the point that on creation day one, for the first time, light passes through the clouds and reaches the surface of the waters of planet Earth. And today, we understand exactly how that happened. Something called the moon-forming event basically reduced our atmosphere from being 200 times thicker than what it is today to the thickness we have today. In fact, that's one of the requirements for advanced life. You need to be living on a large, rocky planet with a very thin atmosphere and a very thin layer of water. We're now finding Earth-like planets outside of our solar system, but those where we can measure the water content comes in at 100 to 500 times greater than we see here on planet Earth. Too much water is just as much of a problem for life as too little water. And in creation day two, it says, let there be water above and water below. And creation day two has come under a lot of attack from liberal theologians and scientists alike because they presume that this water above and water below is something other than what the text is actually saying. And what they're overlooking is this. Of all the creation days, you get the briefest description on creation day two. But for the simple reason, it's not necessary to give a more detailed description. We now have textual evidence that the content of the book of Job predates that of Genesis by 5 or 6 centuries. You can read about that in my book, Hidden Treasures in the Book of Job. But when it comes to creation day two, you've got all of Job 37 and the first half of Job 38 that focus on creation day two. And the Israelites already had that, so there's no need for Moses to repeat it. But if you go into those chapters in Job, it talks about God setting up this amazing water cycle with multiple forms of frozen precipitation and multiple forms of liquid precipitation. Actually, 16 different forms. These are the 6 predominant ones that it talks about, making the point that if you want life and civilization all over the continents of planet Earth, you need all these different forms of precipitation. We don't just have a water cycle. We have an amazingly fine-tuned water cycle that permits the existence of global high-technology civilization. For example, I live in California. We couldn't grow the crops in California if it wasn't for a heavy snowfall that occurred every winter. Now, if you want to see how exactly this happened, you can get our DVD, Journey Toward Creation. It is out on our booth, and we now have it in 11 languages, but you'll see about a 5-minute segment of that DVD that explains the miracle of what happened in order to enable us to have light coming through the atmosphere and this amazing water cycle. Creation Day 3, it says, let dry ground appear. And this is a reference to God transforming our planet from a water world where there's only oceans on the surface to a world where we got both oceans and continents coexisting. And only if you got oceans and continents coexisting can you recycle the nutrients that are essential to make possible the existence of plants and animals. And so not until you have continental land masses do you have anything other than microbial life here on planet Earth. Now, this is something we're able to put to the test. So, for example, I was reading this at age 17, and that was back in the late 1950s. And at that time, what you saw in the geology textbooks was that the continents had always been here. But I remember reading those textbooks at age 17 and recognizing that this was an assumption, that the continents had already been here. There was no real data to establish that indeed the continents have always been here. So I remember reading Genesis and saying, I'm wondering how this is going to play out as we learn more and more about the geological history of the Earth. But this was a story in the 1950s. Then I enrolled at the University of British Columbia, and when I was a sophomore, 2 of the scientists that had launched the discipline of plate tectonics. There were 3 of them, but 2 of the 3 were at the University of British Columbia, and they actually taught the first course ever given on plate tectonics. And I enrolled in that course. Somehow they let me in as a sophomore. And what they taught in that course is that plate tectonics establishes that there's a growth in the continents covering the surface of the Earth. And basically, they were claiming that there was this gradual buildup of continental land masses on the surface of the Earth. I remember going to one of those 2 professors and saying, well, you're telling us that it probably started off at the level of 7 to 8%. How certain is that? And he said, well, it could be anywhere from 0 to 10%. And I said, okay, I wonder how that's going to play out as we continue to learn more and more. But what I want you to notice is by the 1960s, we got a much closer fit with what Genesis teaches about creation day 3 than we had in the 1950s. But as we jump forward to the year 2000, we now knew enough about the plate tectonic history of the Earth to realize that the Bible got it right, namely that the Earth starts off as a water world. Then we get these tiny volcanic islands, then plate tectonics kicks in, the continents begin to grow. But what you notice in this study in 2000 is that the period of time where we got the most aggressive growth of the continental land masses is when the Earth is a little bit less than half of its present age. Where does Genesis 1 put it? It puts it at the beginning of creation day 3, so 6 days of creation, and we can see that the timing in Genesis is consistent with the timing we see in this detailed study of the plate tectonic history of the Earth. Okay, now I want you to jump forward to March of 2018. In March of 2018, a paper was published where they said, we now understand what it is that jumpstarts the growth of the continental land masses. It's oxygen. When the basalts below the surface of the earth get oxygenated, we see an explosive growth of the continents. And what they're referring to is something called the first great oxygenation event. And basically they're making the point that that great oxygenation event would have catapulted the growth of the continental land masses. And so this is the latest picture on the history of the growth of the continental land masses. And now we notice we've got a perfectly tight fit with what Genesis 1 has been claiming for thousands of years. Namely, that for about the first billion years, Earth indeed is a water world. Then plate tectonics gradually kicks in to where the continents now cover about 1.5% to 2% of the surface of the Earth. Then you get the great oxygenation event, and we go from 1.5% to 2% up to 27%, and then it gradually grows to the present 29%. Now, if you want to read about this in lay language, I wrote a blog on June 11th. My blog is called Today's New Reason to Believe. It's archived at reasons.org. Literally every week I publish about a 1,000-word blog where I talk about a brand new scientific discovery that gives us a stronger case for the Christian faith than we had before. And it's that blog that talks about this oxygenation event and how we now have this perfect fit with what Genesis 1's been teaching about creation day 3. But in creation day 3, it also talks about how once we got the continents in place, God has plants beginning to proliferate on the continental land masses. Actually, what the text says is, let the land produce vegetation. And the Hebrew word for vegetation is dasheh, and it's basically referring to photosynthetic life. And so anything that produces sugars and starches and fats through photosynthesis qualifies. But it's basically making the point that once the continents are in place, the continents are going to be proliferated with this vegetation. I think what gives people some pause is that they actually see three examples. Let the land produce vegetation. Here are three examples: trees, seeds, and fruits. Now, in the Hebrew, these terms are far more generic than they are in the English, but I also want you to understand this is not intended to be an exhaustive list. It's three examples. Or another way to look at it, let the land produce dasheh, vegetation, colon, here's three examples. Okay. I've had the privilege of debating Michael Shermer, the executive director of the Skeptic Society, four times on university campuses. We've never had a scheduled debate in Genesis. But what I notice about Michael Shermer, it doesn't matter what the subject is, he always goes straight to Genesis 1 because he sees that as the Achilles heel of the Christian faith. And what he's challenged me in all of those debates, he says, Hugh, if you look at the fossil record, it tells us we get animals in the oceans first and then we get plants on the continents next. Your Bible puts it the other way around. Therefore, your Bible is wrong. Therefore, there's no scientific basis for the Christian faith. Now, my response in the first of those debates was to point out, wait a minute, Michael. Animals have bones and shells. Therefore, they're going to be easily preserved for hundreds of millions of years. That's not the case with plants. They're going to decay much more readily. So it's not surprising to me that we don't have fossils of plants that date previous to 600 million years. They're simply not going to survive that length of time without being destroyed beyond recognition. But what happened is that in 2009 and 2011, two papers were published in the British journal Nature. And the first of those papers said, we don't have the fossil evidence, but we now have isotope evidence that vegetation was proliferating on the continental land masses for 200 million years before the first appearance of animals in the oceans. And then in 2011, they said, we finally found the fossils. That's a bit of an overstatement. They found fossil parts. The biggest part they found was 1 millimeter across. But it was enough to document that vegetation had proliferated on the continental land masses for 600 million years before the first appearance of animals in the ocean. So this is another demonstration that the more we learn about science, the more evidence we gain that Genesis 1 got it right and it got it perfectly correct. Then we move into Creation Day 4. And Creation Day 4 says, let there be lights in the sky. And it's a reference to the fact that we have this atmosphere that lets light through from the sun, moon, and stars. But not until Creation Day 4 can creatures on the surface of the earth actually see the objects in the sky that are responsible for the light coming through. This is when God transforms our atmosphere from being translucent to transparent. If you actually read all of verse 14, it says, let there be the great lights so that they may serve as signs to mark seasons, days, and years. Now, God's about to create animals. Of all the life on planet Earth, it's the animals that must be able to see the position of the sun, moon, and stars in the sky in order to regulate their complex biological clocks. The bacteria don't need that. The algae don't need that. But the animals must have that information. And this is why we see God transforming the atmosphere from translucent to transparent. Now, I was referring earlier to the first great oxygenation event. That happened when the Earth was about 2.2 billion years old. But there's a second great oxygenation event, actually a greater oxygenation event, that happened about 575 million years ago. And this is when the oxygen content in the atmosphere went from less than 1% up to 8%. And this is when we see the sudden appearance of animals. This is when we see our world having nothing but microbes on it and colonies of microbes to where we now see animals for the first time. Animals need a minimum of 8% oxygen in the atmosphere. Now, what happened a couple of months ago is a paper got published in Geophysical Research Letters, where a group of physicists said, let's actually put to the test what happens when we go from less than 1% oxygen in the atmosphere up to 8%. So they did an experiment where they basically simulated the Earth's atmosphere in flasks, where they began with 20 parts per million oxygen and went all the way up to 80,000 parts, which is 8% per million. And what they noticed was when you go from 20 parts up to 80,000 parts, the atmosphere becomes progressively less and less hazy. And at 20 parts, it's so hazy that you can't really see anything beyond, say, a hand's length. So what I've done here to try to give you an idea of what this would do in the context of Creation Day 4 is show you a photo that I've taken of Engineer Peak in Colorado. And I overlaid it with a haze that would be similar to what you would see with 1% oxygen in the atmosphere. And then gradually increase the oxygen content, and what you see is the atmosphere becomes progressively less and less hazy as the oxygen content rises to a greater and greater level. And when it hits 80,000 parts per million, you actually are now able to see the objects in the sky that are responsible for the light coming through. And again, if you want to read about this in more detail, you can see my blog on June 18th at reasons.org. And to complete the story, this is the complete history of the oxygenation of the atmosphere, namely that it jumps, how the oxygen content goes up to 8%, and that's when you get the Avalon explosion of animals, where we go from nothing but microbes to where you now have animals with body sizes up to 2 meters across. And there's no time delay. You go from nothing but microbes to these animals instantly the moment the oxygen jumps up to that 8% level, and then it jumps up to 10%, and that's when you get the Cambrian explosion. This is when, for the first time, you see animals with brains, with hearts, a circulatory system, a digestive tract. Those kinds of animals need a minimum of 10% oxygen in the atmosphere. But the moment the oxygen goes up to 10%, immediately you have these animals. And then it jumps up to 20% and is present 21%, and that's the oxygen content you need for birds and mammals. And again, no delay. Creation Day 5 it says, let the waters teem with living creatures. This is a reference to God creating the first animals on planet Earth. And indeed, the fossil record verifies that the first animals are animals that we see in the oceans. And again, no time delay. And in my book, Improbable Planet, I quote from seven different evolutionary biologists, none of whom are believers, who comment on this sudden appearance of animals, where we go from microbes to animals suddenly without a time delay. This is from Kevin Peterson. He says, elucidating the materialistic basis for the Cambrian explosion has become more elusive, not less, the more we know about the event itself. Basically making the point we've been making at Reasons to Believe for the past 30 years, that the more we learn about science, the stronger case we get for the inerrancy of the Bible and the Christian faith. And it was even Richard Dawkins who said, with reference to the Cambrian explosion, these animals come out of nowhere with no evolutionary history. Naturalistic models would predict a historical development. That's not what we see. Moreover, when we see the Avalon animals and the Cambrian animals appear on the scene, they appear immediately with optimized ecological relationships. Evolutionary models would predict tens of millions and not hundreds of millions of years for the predator-prey relationships, for example, to become optimized. We don't see that in the fossil record. Every time, we see that immediately you get optimized predator-prey relationships. If you want to read more about this, it's covered in my book, Improbable Planet. And then Creation Day 5, Part 2, it uses for the first time the word create, or the second time. The first time you see it, Genesis 1:1, where God creates the physical universe. The second time you see it is when God creates soulish animals. This is when God creates animals that are not just physical, they're physical and soulish, referring to the birds and the sea mammals. And these are creatures that God has endowed with mind, will, and emotions so that they can form relationships with one another at emotional level, but also with a higher species, namely us human beings. That God designed these birds and mammals to relate to a higher species and to serve and please that higher species. And that's dealt with in much more detail in the book of Job. Then Creation Day 6, it talks about God creating three specialized kinds of land mammals. The short-legged land mammals and two different kinds of long-legged land mammals. Those that are easy to tame, a reference to the herbivores that we use for agriculture. And then another kind of long-legged land mammal that is difficult to tame, a reference to the carnivores. And the carnivores do not make good agricultural animals, but they make excellent household companions. And the whole point is God gave us some of these animals to serve us, like the cows, the sheep, and the goats, and others like the lions and the cats and the dogs that are designed to please us and to be companions to us. And you can read about this in much more detail in Hidden Treasures in the book of Job. And I actually wrote that book with this principle in mind. Job says in chapter 12, look to these birds, look to these mammals, they will teach you, they will instruct you. And what he meant is they'll teach you and instruct you about spiritual truths. Because what he was pointing out, notice that these animals are designed to serve and please a higher species. Likewise, we human beings are designed to serve and please a higher being. Notice that your sin causes these animals to run away from you instead of their natural tendency to come towards you. Likewise, it's our sin that causes us to run away from God or to pretend that he doesn't exist rather than our natural tendency that God gave us to seek him out and to relate to him. And likewise, notice it takes a higher being to tame these animals. Likewise, it takes a higher being to tame us human beings. That's how the book of Job ends, where God says, you've been able to tame all these animals, but there's one species of life you cannot tame. You cannot bring humility to a proud human heart. It takes a higher being to do that. Job came to me for that. The rest of you did not. And then last of all, Genesis talks about God creating human beings. And this is the third time that it uses the word create. It says God made us and he created us. There's something about us that's not brand new, but there's something about us that is brand new, namely the spirit that we have. We're the only species that God has created that is spiritual in nature here on planet Earth. And so the birds and mammals are physical and soulish. We are physical, soulish, and spiritual. And so these animals can relate to us. God gave us a spirit so we can relate to Him. And we've written a book on this, Who is Adam? Basically making the point, we humans are exceptional. And if you read the literature being put out by non-believing anthropologists, one of the things you discover, they've got no answer from a naturalistic perspective for the origin of human consciousness. Why? It's simply not physical in nature. There's something about us that is not physical. Well, having put Genesis 1 to the test, once we understand that these creation days are six consecutive literal long periods of time, and that the frame of reference is the surface of the earth, we see that we get a scientific accuracy score of 10 for 10. And that's part of my story. You know, there's over 100 different creation stories in the different holy books and religions of the world. The only one that gets a perfect score is Genesis chapter 1. The Bible is the only one that gets a perfect score. I'll tell you which one places second. The Enuma Elish of the Babylonian creation story gets 2 out of 14 right. You say, how do the other 98 score? They get 0. 2 out of 14, 0. The Bible gets a perfect score of 10 for 10. And that was my first inkling as a 17-year-old that this book, the Bible, is different. It got a perfect score, and it was written thousands of years ago. So it was my first piece of evidence that the Bible indeed is the inspired, inerrant Word of God. And I spent 2 years going through the Bible and looking for places where the Bible might have got the science wrong. I couldn't find any. And I found hundreds of places where it made future, it basically predicted future scientific discoveries thousands of years in advance. And my conversion story is calculating the probability that the Bible would get those hundreds of scientific predictions correct without being divinely inspired, and that probability was less than one chance in 10 to the 300th power. And so I said, hey, we can only demonstrate the reliability of the second law of thermodynamics to one part in 10 to the 80th. The Bible is 10 to the 220 times more reliable than the second law of thermodynamics. I trust my life to that second law. I've got to trust my life to the message of the Bible. But again, and incidentally, I'm not the only scientist that's come to that conclusion. I've seen many scientists come to faith in Jesus Christ through a similar experience. But they're kind of like me. It doesn't happen in a day or a week. They have to give it detailed study. But I also notice through that detailed study, they wind up with a very strong faith. Anyway, you can read more about this at going to reasons.org/Ross. The book is downstairs. Also, what we have downstairs is a DVD small group series where you can literally take skeptics through Genesis 18 minutes at a time with a video. We actually recorded this series in front of an audience of 17 to 34-year-olds where many of them were not believers. And you actually get to see in the video how they're transformed as they go through this experience week after week. And it's a great tool to show skeptics how reliable the Bible is and to encourage them to give their life to Christ. But again, the more we learn about science, the more reasons we gain to believe that the Bible is God's Word. Hey, we've got about, we've got a significant amount of time left. I'm going to take the rest of the time for questions. And I'll take a question on any topic. It doesn't have to be what I spoke on today. So I'll begin with you, sir. Yeah, okay. The question is death before sin. And yeah, there are other Christian research groups who are claiming that the Bible declares, since there is no death before sin, that the earth and the universe can't be billions of years old. That's the basic argument. Okay. They're misreading what Romans 5 says. Romans 5 says that because of Adam's sin, death came upon all people. It doesn't say death came upon all life. It says death came upon all people. And if you read the whole of Romans 5:12, it says death through sin came upon all people. Only one species of life can possibly experience sin here on earth. That's us human beings. So notice that Paul gives two very careful qualifications to say Adam's offense brought death to humanity for the first time. He's not saying it brought death to all life for the first time. It's death to all humanity for the first time. Nowhere in the Bible does it say that there was no death of plants and animals until the sin of Adam. So that's a mistake, and I deal with that in some detail in my book, A Matter of Days. But yeah, definitely, it was Adam's offense that brought death to us for the first time. Adam and Eve had access to the tree of life. And notice, once Adam and Eve sinned, God took away that access. He did not want us to live forever in a physical state. Because if that was the case, we would have been spiritually dead forever. So God actually uses physical death as a tool to redeem us from spiritual death. In that sense, physical death is a gift that God bestowed upon humanity. Okay, this gentleman here. Right. Okay. Yeah, the reference is that we have another creation study group saying that we humans came from a large population of humans, not just two individuals, Adam and Eve. And probably the primary promoter of that is the organization BioLogos that's been founded by Francis Collins. We at Reasons to Believe have been in more than a 10-year dialogue with the scientists and theologians of BioLogos. If you want to read a summary of that dialogue, we came up with a Two Views book published by InterVarsity Press about a year ago. So you can actually read in depth. And kind of what I like about that book is that we have very different views on science and on the Bible. But you get to see us dialogue with one another in a spirit of charity, which is kind of rare for Christians when it comes to the topic of creation and science. It's basically talking, I don't forget the exact title, it's a very long title. InterVarsity Press likes long titles, but it mentions Reasons to Believe in BioLogos in the title on the subject of creation and evolution. But yeah, we take the position that all of humanity is descended from two individuals only, a literal Adam and a literal Eve that God specially created a few tens of thousands of years ago. BioLogos takes the position that we evolved from a common ancestor with the chimpanzees and the Neanderthals, and the ancestral population was in excess of 10,000, not the biblical two. Probably my most recent debate with a scientist at BioLogos was with the president of BioLogos, where I pointed out that I can recall 40 years ago where they said the ancestral population was 1 million. And then it dropped down to 100,000. Then Francis Collins came out with his book where he said 10,000. And when my colleague Fuzz Rana, our staff biochemist, debated Dennis Venema, Dennis went down to 800 to 1,200. And then when I had that debate, Deborah was willing to go down to 132. And I said, well, how about if we plot this on a graph and see where it's going? But the other thing you'll see in the book, the Two Views book we did, is that we cite experiments that have been done because their number at 10,000 is based on a theoretical model that presumes an evolutionary perspective. And I said, well, this is circular. You're presuming an evolutionary perspective to prove an evolutionary outcome. But we said, before we give any credence to a theoretical model, we need to see experiments and observations that are consistent with that model. There have been four such experiments that have been performed. And probably the one that's easiest to explain to a lay audience is they took a pair of sheep, put them on an isolated island where there were no other mammals, and let them reproduce for several generations. They measured the DNA of the original two sheep, then they measured the DNA 10, 12, 15 generations later. What they saw in the later generations was way more genetic diversity than what the theoretical models predicted, basically telling you that number 10,000 is an upper limit. In fact, all those numbers, 1,800, 132, they're all upper limits. It's that or less. And so, as an astronomer, my point is don't believe anything in science until you see the theory confirmed by observations and experiments. Okay, who's next? I'll take somebody in the back. That gentleman in the back there, speak loud, please. Right. Okay, it was carnivorism a result of the fall of Adam. And I would argue that the Bible tells us that humanity was vegetarian until after the flood. But that did not apply to the other animals. So there were carnivores before the fall of Adam. There had to be carnivores before the fall of Adam, because anyone who's been, incidentally, this debate is basically limited to people who live in big cities. And I'm telling all of you, get out of the city once in a while and see what life is actually like. And what you discover is, if you take away the carnivores, the death rate for the herbivores skyrockets. The health and the population level of the herbivores depends on the carnivores removing the sick, the weak, and the dying, and the disease. So the carnivores actually benefit the herbivores. And so, given that we have these laws of physics in place, and the Bible is explicit, the laws of physics we experience now have been in place since the beginning of the universe. And in that sense, we got thermodynamics in place and carnivorous activity in place. But God did say to Adam and Eve that they needed to be on a vegetarian diet. And we got to the time after Noah, he says, now you can eat meat. It's simply this. If you've got the potential to live 800 or 900 years, you're not going to live that long if you're eating meat every day. And so you want to be on a vegetarian diet. And what God was saying to the people following Noah was, you're not going to live long enough for it to make any difference, so if you want to enjoy meat, go ahead. But it's not a reference to the animals, the non-human animals. Okay, how about someone over here? I'll take this one right here. Go ahead. Okay, the question is, the text says God created Adam from the dust of the earth. I actually had Carl Sagan briefly as a professor when I was at the University of Toronto, and he was fond of saying, we're all stardust. And so there have been some Bible interpreters who said, well, what we see there in the second chapter of Genesis is simply a reference that we're composed out of the elements that are common to the dust of the earth that are common to stardust. But as I look at that text, I think it is being more explicit. It's making the point that God personally intervened in a supernatural way to take the dust of the earth and pull together the body of Adam, and then he breathed his spirit into him, and Adam became not just a physical being, but a spiritual being. I mean, the very fact that we see the use of the words asah and bara in Genesis 1 with respect to God creating Adam and Eve tells us this is not just a naturalistic outcome. This is God personally, supernaturally intervening to make it happen. So our position at Reasons to Believe is that Adam and Eve are not the product of naturalistic evolution, but rather we're part of the special creation. And we actually cite experiments that have been done in the field which demonstrate that land mammals that have an adult body size bigger than 7 pounds will go extinct before they can evolve, which means not only are we humans specially created, but the bipedal primates that preceded us, like the Neanderthals, Homo erectus, Australopithecines, likewise, they had to be specially created. And it was actually a dialogue between Fuzrana and the atheist anthropologist Ian Tattersall that gave us a reason why God would do this. Namely, that, for example, Australia and North America and South America, we have no fossils of bipedal primates that preceded us. And when humans came into these continents, they quickly drove to extinction the very animals they needed to launch civilization. explaining why the inhabitants of North and South America and Australia weren't able to get out of the Stone Age until the Europeans brought the animals that they needed. That didn't happen in Africa. Why? Because the animals had this sequence of bipedal primates that basically trained them. When you see tall animals on two legs with weapons in their hands, run. Because after all, what we see in the Bible is that God endowed these animals with a desire to come to us and to relate to us. Now, that works great if there's no sin. But if we're sinful creatures, that could lead to the extinction of these animals. And indeed, that's exactly what happens. There actually is a real divine purpose for God creating the sequence of bipedal primates that preceded us. But we didn't evolve from them. They're all special creation acts. Okay. And I got to watch the time here.
I've heard that, by a couple speakers that dinosaurs could not have existed without a higher level of oxygen. But obviously we have fossil records, and you're telling us that oxygen hasn't gone to above 20%. How could dinosaurs have existed with a smaller oxygen than what some say they needed?
Yeah, there's no problem for dinosaurs existing with, say, 20% oxygen. They could easily survive with 20% oxygen. Now, you would need more oxygen if you actually believe that the Jurassic Park movies are real. Every Jurassic Park movie shows a T-Rex running at 45 miles an hour after a Jeep. I mean, that's in every one of those movies, right? That's not physically possible. A creature that big and that heavy can't move that fast. If it were to move that fast, it would quickly injure itself and die. For example, we see that in basketball. The tallest players are the ones that tend to get injuries. And it's because of the law of gravity. The taller you are, the greater damage you experience when you trip and fall. Well, if you've got these big dinosaurs moving at a high velocity, they're going to quickly injure and kill themselves. They were not moving at that high velocity. Moreover, they were living in shallow water zones. You can't have an animal that big without water to give them buoyancy to protect them from the effects of gravity. The biggest land animal you can have without water support is the elephant. Anything bigger than an elephant is quickly going to experience the effects of the law of gravity, which means if they're not moving fast and if they're wandering around in shallow seas, they don't need as much oxygen as what some creationists claim they need. And here's another refutation. Put the oxygen content as high as what they believe, namely above 25%, everything starts to spontaneously burn. You're going to get grass and forest fires all over the place, and they're going to have nothing to eat. Moreover, we got oxygen proxies in the geological record that tells exactly how much oxygen was on the face of the earth at different times. That graph I showed you, that's an accurate graph. It's accurate to 1% precision or better. And so these claims simply have no scientific basis and have no rationalistic basis when we actually look at the problem of too much oxygen. Don't go to oxygen bars. It's not good for you. Okay, I think this will be the last question because we need to let you out to get to the next talk. Yes, go ahead. You know, very good question. People ask me, what's the most common question I get? The most common question is, if God created the universe, who created God? Now, the fallacy in that question, they're presuming that God is constrained in time the same way we humans are constrained and the rest of the universe is constrained. But notice the space-time theorems tell us that time has a beginning, that time was created by some causal agent beyond space and time. So God is not subject in time the same way we are. Any entity that's constrained to a single dimension of time, where time can't be stopped or reversed, must have some ultimate point of beginning or creation. So that's a really very simple way of proving that everything in the universe must be created by something beyond the universe. But since God created time, since God can create space-time dimensions at will and remove them at will, He's not subject to space and time. Therefore, he can have no beginning, no ending, and not be created. Notice, too, the Bible says that God can arbitrarily compress time and expand time. A day of the Lord is like 1,000 years. 1,000 years is like a day. 1,000 years is like a watch in the night. mathematically, it's only possible to a being that's got access to at least the equivalent of two independent dimensions of time. And if you've got two independent dimensions of time, you could have God dwelling on a timeline here that never crosses or touches the timeline of our universe. As such, he has no beginning, no ending, and is uncreated. And a thing that caught my attention at age 17, the Bible is the only holy book that says of God, no beginning, no ending, and uncreated. That's only possible for a being that's got the capacity to create time. But that's something we can now prove through the space-time theorems. Okay, I'm going to let you go. I will be here to answer questions for a little bit.